forest and then to finish, I'll go through a sequence of love poems, some dark and some dark. Some of these are in my own voice, some are in other voices. Femme fatale speaks. I'm not going to get married, but I'd love to you. Go dancing, smooch with you, wait to be introduced. Take a meaningful look, long for you. I will in the purple heather tumble you. Arms overhead unpeel you, chest to chest coalesce you, in a footbath fingers between toes you. From the grapes of me dangle you, eyes in my fingertips drench you, skin on skin envelop you, two sweat stirs inhale you. I will know you, then miss you. This next poem is about my grandmother. I lived in Kirkcaldy for years as a child, so some of the lines in my poetry come in Irish first. For me, it's the language of intimacy and affection. But I follow them with English anyway, so you don't miss the meaning if you don't understand it. Sorry. Mary Ferriter, R.I.P. 1970. She had no time for fancy. Why fool the children when life is more like eating raw rhubarb dipped in brown sugar from cones of rolled newspaper? We squelched meal through our fingers, then scattered it. Once we helped her chase a hen to send it to sleep, head under wing. She twisted its neck, chuckled at our alarm, then drew us in to the wonder of it. As she plucked it from her lap, a halo of feathers about her white head, we were given one severed leg each, for one core to open, another to close, each waxen claw. Soon we learned to enjoy smashing dead fish's eyes with rocks, watching the mercury discs spill out magic, imagining what thoughts came from their walnut-shaped brains. When a calf died, she opened it, to find the plug of mucus in its lungs, the ball of hair in its stomach, or nothing at all this day. Her advice to my mother on children. Be fond of them, but keep it safe inside your heart. She forgot to see it. The next poem is called Diplopia. I'll just explain three words in this, because it will make more sense. Diplopia is a medical term for double vision, and it's where two different images converge on the part of the brain that tries to make sense of what you see. And what the brain does, the visual cortex does, is it cuts out one of them, blanks out one. When we talk about a squint as well, if somebody's eyes converge, it's a convergent squint, it's going to diverge, the wall eye, the divergent squint. Diplopia. I've always been attracted by a wall eye, the divergent squint. That a person switches their attention between two worlds, the seeing eye and the suppressed eye, adopts the rules of whichever they are in, and all feels right. The suppressed eye gazes at a whole other world, another reality outside of this, a country where clouds reach down their hands, smoothing the creases on the sea's brow. Trees uproot and pogo into the rivers. The tide is mired by three moons pulling on it, and stone starts speaking again. These unused tracks to the visual cortex carry the signal, like a torch shining down the labyrinth of a closed mind, where wavelengths of light, like sound, bend around corners. The dual reality gives depth and breath to perception, to help accommodate whatever this life throws. The other world, in wet darkness, a flicker lingering after the light has gone out, a snail's track shining in its wake, the map's image suppressed. Yet it is still there, even if unseen. starling turns its head. I can't see the movement, just before and after, so I assume that it happens. A baby watches its hands as they move at the speed of falling snow. He doesn't yet know they are his. I always thought a giraffe was replayed in slow motion, unaware that the long limbs and neck cause a temporal delay. My insights arrive without notice. Some rapidly cause my innards to lurch. Others, in a gentle sequence, as protective time lapse release, like the careful unwrapping of presence. There's a house when we lived in Dingle for a year. We went to Dingle for the shopping once a week. And she forgot to buy something on the way out of Dingle. There was Ticket de Rouge, which was a shop to buy the things that she forgot to buy in there. The House of Forgotten Things, Ticket de Rouge. A Virgin Mary blue and white house on the road west of Dingle reminded passers to buy what they had forgotten. What if you could drop off what you needed to forget? Forgotten people in the upstairs room. Forgotten dreams dance on the line in the back kitchen. Forgotten promises kicking the mattresses from under the bed. And forgotten lovemaking tossing sheets and blankets each night. Will the store of memories and passions reach a threshold and self-ignited, take the roof off the house? There was a report on another year ago, 2003 or 2004, called the Savvy Report, and it was a telephone study really of anonymously done and confidentially done on people who have been sexually abused as children. One of the startling results when I was reading through this report was that 70% of those who were telling the interviewer that they'd never met and they would never see and they didn't reveal their identity to, 70% of those who were telling the interviewer about sexual abuse had never told anyone before. So this poem is from that one. Interfered with. The cold drafted, unwitnessed. He spoke of everyday things to her. His smell on her fingers, like the inside of a wet amaranth. The smell stained. She wore her foot up for months after, hoping he would not see her, know her. If no one knows, then it doesn't ever happen. Pre-knowing. Without being aware of it, some part of us registers the feeling of a bag slipping off the back of a bag. The sound of teeth being lifted from a hall table before a car is stolen. The baby's movement slowing to a halt in the womb. A man's body expresses a despondency too, long before his mind knows the family is breaking up. So this short story is called Antemortem, Before Death. As he left his curtains open on summer nights, Carthage awoke at dawn on the day of his death. He showered, then dry-shaved by touch, by looking out the bathroom window at the pylons in the distance. He reheated porridge he had cooked the night before and sat out on the back step to eat. Carthage was a tall man, with a mop of raven black hair, a wiry frame, and a lantern jaw. A dishwasher is a beautiful thing, he said to himself, as he reached in to unclip both rotating arms. He ran the tap water through the center hose and watched the spouts of water coming out each end, like a child spilling water out of the mouth after punching both cheeks. Once he had checked all outlets were clear, he rinsed the filter, then clicked it back into place. Flush. Yet it's a similar ritual with the miner's lamp he cleaned and polished as a child in the original. As he worked, time stood still, and his movements slowed. So it was more like a caress than a duty. He left the house and walked to the tube station where he bought a Roscommon herald. He got off at Ealing and made his way to the hospital. How are you currently? Nothing new at home? Josie, making a cork one, smelling of juicy fruit gum, greeted him from the pathology office. She worked as an administrator, but the pathology chief never made any changes without consulting her. Carthage smiled his crinkly smile, his conversation dodger, and kept walking. Once changed into blue scrubs, he reviewed the morning's list. Two BIDs brought in day, one Annie, and two infant twins. He moved to the first gurney and started to work. Each time he peeled back the layers of the body, he moved quickly, as though expecting to find something specific. In each there was something that the pathologist wanted him to find. The thrombus lodged in the coronary or through the artery, the broken vertebra of the hanging victim, waterlogged lungs in a suspected drowning, or the puncture wound tracking a knife's insertion through the rib space, through the sac around the heart, and into the heart muscle, reaching the inner silken lining of the heart. These were not what Carthage was looking for. As he weighed the heart, lungs, and brain, and noted his findings, his pace slowed. Often, Stephanie walked past the glass block wall. Click-clack, click-clack. That's all I need, he said to himself. An attractive woman, and a bloody curse. He moved on to the twins. They were wrapped together in an orange fleece blanket. Reflexly, he put his little finger inside of each of the tiny fists, as though they would grip him back. They were dressed in yellow woolen hand-knitted suits with buttons of different plastic fruits, little pixie hats with silver bells on them, and laced booties. He undressed them carefully and folded their clothes and unsoiled nappies onto a chair. Then he lifted their sleep blanket, folded it, and, as there was no one else about, pushed his face into it and breathed it in. Other people's homes and the swans that belong there. He laid the twins out on the gurney like two pinned butterflies, and carefully made the incision so the pathologist could get to work. It was only with infants that you had to take great care. Their bodies were held and hugged up to the last before they placed in the coffin. Next he moved on to the hanging. He looked into the man's face. Whatever angst had driven him to it was long gone. His face muscles were relaxed and he looked mellow, as though he might stretch, take a deep breath, and at any moment shout, "Jesus, what's keeping you when you get a move on?" Carthage took down the drill and started to bore the dead man's skull. He removed the brain and waited, then moved on to open the chest and abdomen. The pathologist wore masks while they worked. Carthage didn't bother. The smell of innards was no consequence to him, whether animal or human. Through the open window, he smelled cigarette smoke and stopped working. As he stripped off his gloves and apron and washed his hands, he remembered two things about Mary that he loved most. The sweet thread of tobacco that his tongue invariably found in some crevice of his mouth after waving her goodbye, and the soft curve at the top of her leg where her thigh muscle attached to her hip bone. A small pad of flesh quivered there when she moved. He loved to rest his head on her stomach inside that curve, and run his fingertips over her firm muscle nest of soft flesh. It was the only part of her. It was the only soft part of her. Lying there felt like home. He walked down the corridor, quickly past the open door of the packet staff room. Inside the back door, with the press of a button, the coffee machine spat a black steaming liquid into a beige plastic cup. Outside, he fished a cigarette from his pocket and lit it. Sanjeev, a small man in his 60s, with pianist hands, a limp and sad eyes, smoked in silence, leaning one foot against the wall. Both men nodded once to the other and looked away. They could have been outside a church in Mohan on a warm spring Sunday, studiously ignoring the priest's request to show each other the sign of peace. Each day, Carthage went to the staff room before the others, opened his lunchbox, and unwrapped the same piece of tinfoil with the sandwich inside. Lunch today was two slices of soda bread with lumps of smoked ham, scallions, and mayonnaise. When he had finished, he left the room, biting on a red apple as the others arrived. He walked across the hospital football pitch into the woods and lay on a mossy bank beside the stream. He looked up at the sun through the leaves. Mary smelled his popcorn. It wasn't from her face cream or makeup, because he had checked them. It was from deep inside her. He could find it in her nasal exhale there as she lay asleep beside him, and he moved his clothes to re-breathe her. It wafted from her pores in the heat. He looked down at the shadows made by the leaves on his hands. They were like shadows that moved across the bottom of a watch face when floods float along the water surface. It reminded him of the cloud shadow tacking along the side of Ben Baldwin on a fresh windy day. He left the woods and detoured to Davy's bookies before returning to the lab. "Hello, Irish. What can I do for you?" £2 each way on a birch rider, 4 o'clock. Pat took the money and gave him his docket. Pat was Ruth Hunsman, bald, with ginger eyebrows, a patchy ginger beard with a red rash poking through, and fish-like blue eyes with long blonde eyelashes. "Done. Will you be in Flanagan for one later? Marty's coming down for the night. You'll be there after 9. "Probably. See you soon." Carthage spent the afternoon working on sections of the organs he had removed, taking slices at angles that best showed the cause of death, whether from disease or trauma. Stephanie clicked in and out, transferring those sustained to the lab upstairs. She was a buxom woman in her late 30s, the kind who assaults the senses with noisy shoes, garish clothes, strong perfume, and a tendency to stand too close. She reminded him she was having a hen party that night after work. Her fiancé, Igor, a Russian plasterer, was a powerful building man. The more she crowded Carthage, the more he withdrew, just to the point that now he didn't need eye contact or reply to her anymore. His final job that day with Sanji was to stitch clothes, the ribcage, chest, and abdomens and skulls as neatly as possible. At 5 o'clock, they went to their last cigarette of the day. Sanji's long toes were out to Sandy. They curled the grass, combing it as he spoke. "2 years I have left here in this dung hole. My wife, she loves it. But in my heart, I am still in the cold. I have never let my everyday mind visit the market and breathe in the aromas the curries along with the putrid smells. I yearn for them all. 2 more years, if God is willing." The two men's eyes met and held, then Carthage looked away. In Ealing Village, he bought 2 fillet steaks, a head of white cabbage and new potatoes, and he took a bus ride before it stopped. At the doorway beside Flanagan's, he kicked away a pile of soiled blankets and climbed the metal stairs. The tips of his shoes ting, and the plastic food bags pushing against the metal rail. At the top, he rang the doorbell. After waiting 5 minutes, he put a key in the lock and let himself in. The apartment was dark and stuffy, smelling of wine, spices, and dough. He opened the curtains and the windows. In the kitchen, he set the cabbage and potatoes boiling, then washed the frying pan, dried it, stood rock salt onto it, and laid the 2 steaks to cook on top. The bedroom door was wedged half open by a pile of clothes. Tarek lay sprawled on the bed, his face was obscured by his long hair. A beam of light from the evening sun lit up one buttock and a thin, black-haired leg. Carthage bent over, kissed him on the back of his neck, and slapped the bare buttock. "Wydenshine, dinner in 10 minutes. Tarek rolled around, surprised, and wiped saliva from his chin. His eyes were bloodshot. In the kitchen, Carthage whistled while he cleaned. He listened for the racing news on Radio 1, then turned it off and listened to Tarek singing in the shower. Flanagan's was a comfortable pub until the new owners replaced the formica and bubble glass with mahogany snugs, coloured metal assets with skin, and shelves with blackened pots, kettles, and old books. Now it looked more like a state set with Playboy's Western World. Despite this, the regulars continued to drink there. Mikey, a red-faced Bricky with a fading sunburn line on his neck, carrots for fingers and a lift, was seated at the bar with his phantom chaser. He regaled Harris behind the bar with his victorious story, the theme always his ingenuity, the great man he was, and fooling the Englishman. Harris' attention was on the function room at the back, where screams of laughter and singing were heard each time the door opened. Just outside the function room, Igor and his two Ukrainian friends sat like guards drinking lard. On the other side of the bar, two young Bengali men dressed in suits were deep in conversation. Carthage was smoking, leaning against the wall while passing Marty played pool. The cool two was like a talking stick. Each took their turn to speak before taking a shot. Marty was telling a story about an M1 motorway rescue call-out he had done that day. So he says to me, "You're ripping us off, mate. That's double your charge for petrol." So I said, "I'm not your mate. Take it or leave it. I'm not here for the good of the health. Like it or lunch." "What did he say to that?" Pat grinned. "Well, he went back to the car. You should have seen it. His wife all meek like, but his mother, she bawled him out of it. He paid in the end, though. No choice. What did they expect? Everything from..." Carthage watched Tarek as he served pints to the two young men. When they took their seats again, Tarek caught his eye and Carthage looked away. The function room door opened and women in various stages of drunkenness filled out. They wore pink hairbands with fluffy antennae and flashing lights. Josie marched to the middle of the room and set down a high stool. "Well, it's Stephanie's last time in here, a single woman, so we'll have a kiss, a nice orderly kiss now from every man in the room. Form a queue, lad." Stephanie swaggered over to the stool in a bright red dress with a plunging neckline, jingling bangles, patterned black tights, and stilettos. She perched coquettishly on the edge of the stool. Her head dropped as Mikey staggered over to her from the bar. He wiped both his hands on his trousers and his mouth with his sleeve. He approached her stealthily, his elbows sticking out from his body on each side, like a man might approach a wild dog. She pointedly turned her head to the side to receive his kiss on her cheek. Next up was Pat, who walked shyly towards her, placed a hand on each shoulder and kissed her on both cheeks. "I wish you the very best. I'm sorry we're losing you till last year." "Congratulations." "It's been much of a much fun." Igor straightened up in his seat, craning to hear what was being said. Marty sauntered up to Stephanie next and pulled her out for a quick jig around the room. Igor stood, looking alarmed. Marty winked at them as they passed. Josie announced a break in the proceedings, and the women went to the bar for another drink. Stephanie leaned to Carthage's arm as he leaned over the bar. "You missed your chance with me. How do you feel about that?" He took a deep draw on his pipe and walked away. "Just who do you think you are, Mr. God Almighty? I was talking to you. Don't just walk away when I'm talking to you." Her shoulders slapped the strap slipped, and he go and moved swiftly to her side. "This man a problem? Is he bothering you?" "Nah." She turned back to Josie. Carthage took up the pool chair and continued to play, ignoring Igor watching him. Josie steered Stephanie back to her school. "Last chance, lads, we'll have three more kisses for the lovely Stephanie before she is lost forever into marriage." Igor stayed standing at the bar, his pint in his hand and his hooded eyes facing the room. The two young Bengalians stood and approached Stephanie. The first in an ill-fitting suit and plastic shoes pecked her cheek shyly and hurried back to his seat. His friend in a linen suit, leather shoes and wearing strong aftershaves kissed her on the lips and his hand rested briefly on her breast. She craned into the kiss. Igor put down his pint slowly and bounded over. He grabbed his arm, twisted it and kicked him to the floor and started to kick him in the face and stomach. Stephanie staggered back, staring, fascinated, in a disconnected way. Carthage intervened. "It's enough. Back off. He's only a kid." Josie stepped between the two men, placing a hand on each arm, as they stared hard at each other over the man on the floor, with nostrils flaring. "Lads, lads, man, let's not calm down. It's all back to your seat." Igor's two friends accompanied him back to his seat into a fresh conversation room. Carthage and Josie helped the young man off the floor. He retrieved his glasses and dusted down his clothes. His left eye was swollen and he had a cut lip. He left the bar quickly with his friend. The smell of wet leaves filled the room. as Tarek opened the back door to change a kick. The hen party, now just five women, sat around a table, and the bar hushed as each took a turn to sing a folk song. The songs were of love and loss. The Irishmen sat playing pool and leaned on their cues, as they would on the crook of ash by climbing footpaths. Igor and his two friends looked somber inside, each alone in his world. At the end of Josie's song, when Tarek turned up the lights and opened the front door, the atmosphere changed again. The street was shiny after a shower. Sorry, love, folks, but it's time now. Please, ladies and gentlemen, time. Stephanie stood at the door and hugged each of her friends as they left. Carter sat at the end of the bar watching Tarek clear up. Igor came out of the men's toilet and Stephanie taunted him. I never got my kiss from you. Will you not wish me luck? Carthage looked straight at her. Good luck. Then he turned on his stool and faced the bar. Igor exchanged looks with two friends when they left the head of them with Stephanie. Carthage swept the land as Tarek finished putting the glasses into the machine and he switched off the lights and they left by the front door. Tarek turned on the alarm and locked the outer door. Carthage heard his dog thud behind him as he placed his foot on the first step of the metal stairway. When he looked around, Tarek was on the ground being kicked by two men. He lunged to punch the nearest when he felt a blow to the side of his head. He heard a high-pitched hissing sound like a burst main pipe as his body folded to the ground. His fractured temporal bone could no longer protect his artery. Blood pumped from the severed artery, filling the space and expanding to compress the soft brain against the hard casing of his skull. The blood clot grew from the size of a bean to that of a tennis ball. Carthage was sleeping curled up beside Mary, her head tucked under his chin, her shoulders against his chest, her back fitting the curves of his stomach, her buttocks against his groin, his members between her legs at the point of entry, her hips encased by his hands, her thighs, knees and calves draped like a rug across his, her feet like two mackerel rolled in newspaper between both of his. She was so cold he couldn't warm her. He could hear Tarek calling him as a red canopy over the bed slowly closed them in. He wasn't leaving her, not now. The bed slowly lowered down the mine shaft into a cold, damp So back to varieties of love and what it can do to you. So the first one is about obsession. So love turns pathological. And when that happens, it can make us sick if we can't release ourselves from the earth. Unrequited, pathological. I'm jealous of the air he breathes in his place, the water that washes over him, lingering randomly in a horizontal bodily process, the mirror he peers into, the comb that traces his hair pattern, the aftershave that lingers on his face, the clothes that variously unfold him, the socks that envelop his awkward toes, the leather shoes his feet give shape. I'm jealous of the ground that meets his outstretched foot, the seat he yields his weight to, the leather bag he grips purposefully, the business he attends to, the friends he embraces, the colleagues who relate. Sarcastic. Not seeing the angel within. Not feeling the warm tide of his love wash over their soul. I yearn for fights unfought, love unnamed, children unborn, depths of mutual knowing unreached. I wish to know him with all of my senses. My world is beige. My feelings have changed. My mind is not here. This one's splendid, Pastor. Mate, you answer the advert. You're lonely. You're blue. How tall did you say?
Yes,
lost Campbell into hiding. Last visit for years. Green eyes, that's nice. So you gave up on meeting the one, just as your younger self lost interest in county football, once you knew you would never make the team. You seem warm, easygoing. I'm not sure why you tell me you have all of your teeth. Your longest relationship, just 7 months. Truth, your defense. You did not love her with all of your being, so you left. How long is your hair? You prefer telly to reading. You watched your friends marry, for children, companionship, occasionally for love, not you. You insist you are very genuine, as though they were great. It doesn't seem worthwhile to set the table for one. Now the four walls close in on you. You settle for an occasional text, talk, meet. Knowing only first names, you speak on a telephone line, in the quiet of the night, from two empty hands, hundreds of miles apart, tender at this vulnerable level. So, we will meet, see what life has done to each of us, what proof there is in the flesh. Long verbal cues will grapple, and there, our premature intimacy, we let. The next form of reflections is based on the idea that psychologists have that when you fall in love, you have very little to do with the person you're falling in love with, because it's actually narcissistic. You're falling in love with the image of yourself that you see in them, that they project back to you. Mm-hmm. Reflection. Apparently, I will love me in you. Swear blind your uniqueness, deliciousness, transparency, touchness, the reason why. But it is my reflection in you that will seduce me. Some places in me may resonate your lonesome part. Your hands may feel sound, your chin feel manly in mine. My resolution express a forcefulness you haven't found within, or my softness reflect for you parts you have not reached. How will you feel when you see your feminine in me? Will you trust me enough to become who you were born to be? And then, of course, there's a pure essentiality, thing of love, you know, it stops time completely. Unleash. We lie naked on the rocks, sun glistens warm and drying skin. Air, water, still, clear, receding waves, scuttle with stone. Sensuous touch, unspooled identity. Boundaries fade. Who's now? Who's seen it? Just covers we wear. We return to the grey faces, the pavement, time packaged again. This one's called Gelsa, the Irish for engage. It's actually means fast. I feel wedded to you in a way that no ring can encompass, no promises can fortify, nor a love child can consolidate, no breakup can sully, nor a dark words tarnish. You are within me, in a place your probing parts will never touch. The cool template to my magma, and in your breastplate to my core. And sometimes, too deeply for somebody, you come across part of them that's maybe damaged or hurt and that really nobody can reach, or certainly you feel you can't reach, in the sense that it won't heal, no matter what you feel for. On the couch, I find your hope in the nail bed of your big toe, being inside the creek of your clenched fist. Worries under my thumbs as they splay your cheekbones. Confidences in the soft, silvery skin of your instep. I find your age in your unyielding spine. Massage your ankles while you unravel feet. Light strokes your naked face as you disentangle bitter truths. I blush and reduce the task for the warm pulse of my palms with tears tumbling. I can only reach your periphery. And then, of course, there's that awful feeling of deja vu you get when love turns to damage. Second thought. Easier to think it in as it leaves the familiar path, slices through webs of scar. The sucking sound of steel withdraws from soft, live flesh. Gelatinous matter obliterates the breach, swiftly gums parted layers. Am I? What am I? It'll never happen. If only the soul has such protective instincts. It lies with its chest bare, trusting, gullible, amnesic, until the sound of steel on stone reminds, disbelief, not again, and hurtles down the stairs of the hall. Penumbra is about the last time you do something and you don't always know, and you generally don't know the last time you do it, till afternoon. Often when you make love, your mind wanders all over. Capillary, Kilcomon, doors. Your body routinely follows its flock memory to the arrival point. Had you known it would be your last time together, you would have stretched it out for days. Fry rolls to it and strips on the rocks. Exhausted parallel lines from hooks on a tarred timber frame, smoked it with peat and willow, poured it with marinade into labeled pre-warmed glass jars with lids to vacuum seal. And then there's that purity of feeling of just leaking. Hair shirt. I can't wear enough layers. The draft on my neck, my ice cream faces. The chill on my tonic and your touchful eyes. The hollow in my chest for your palms honed, steady in the center of the spinning top. Brown webs have covered it. Feet are gone from it. Where are you? The place you lived inside me billows, like a wet sheet snapping in the wind. Lighter note. So the relationship ends, and then you have the decision, do you send back everything that belongs to them, or do you keep it? Or do they send back everything? And when they do, what do you do? This one's called A Garland of Freshly Cut Tears, and the line is from a Leonard Cohen song called Take This Walk. You sent me your socks. The parcel so heavy it might have been body parts. What could it mean? That life of socks is no longer worth living. That you will go sockless forever without me. That you cried bitter tears into them each morning after I left. That the world would be a better place without socks and or me. That we, socks and I, deserve each other. That you would like me to wear them in your memory. What about your malevolence? Shall I wear that too? Maybe your shoes torn out so things are rest will follow. Why did you bother to send anything at all? Then we can't give them back to where I left you. And to finish, just a short love one. Hymen. You were the river beneath my village, a constant fresh flow, a silent companion to my days. I am the sea all about you, eating into your cliffs, tide marking your empty beaches, as you stare into your star-fucked sky. Thanks very much.